This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We've been talking about poetry this hour, and we're joined now by another distinguished poet, Alan Shapiro, a professor of English at UNC Chapel Hill, spent his life writing and teaching poetry. He has a new book of essays that offers insights into how conventions of literature can mirror conventions of life. That is called The Self-Forgetful, Perfectly Useless Concentration. And he also has a new volume of poetry that was informed deeply by his personal events in his life, including the death of his mother. And that collection is called Life Pig. Alan Shapiro joins me in the studio now. Welcome back, Alan. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank.
Let's start with these essays now, critical essays, about poetic forms, but personal and entertaining as well. What got you thinking about sort of poetic and literary forms?
Well, I mean, as a writer, you are constantly concerned and with forms, and how do you fit personal experience? Mm. How do you integrate personal experience and individual emotion to these forms, which are impersonal, inherited from a tradition?
But they're behind the scenes, and I guess the point of my question was, what made you think I'd care, right? I mean, so the idea that form is an interesting, that we should step back and examine the way personal experience and form works together.
Well, apart from just innate narcissism, just assume that you would care about anything I care about.
That's right.
But aside from that, I think that because the forms of literature do mirror the forms of life, and that the problem of writing individual life into an impersonal form is similar to how we express our identities off the page by means of social norms. I mean, we measure ourselves against these norms, which we did not create. We didn't invent. We inherit them. They're already there. And similar to what Jackie was talking about, these are certain forms of life that you're born into.
Right.
So there's parts of our life that we get to author ourselves. There are other parts of our life that are authored for us. And the whole struggle of writing is to sort of gain a little bit more agency over the terms of existence. And I think that's also true for all of us in our everyday lives.
To what extent do you think, because you're limited, it seems to me, somewhat as a writer, any artist, in the forms that you choose. I mean, you can go way out of bounds and just create your own form, but then you risk leaving everybody behind, right? So you're stuck with various forms.
Right. Well, look at it this way. And I mean, I'm also thinking about forms just in terms of the forms of language, like the forms of sentences. Mm. You know, your emotions, your sensations, your thoughts are inside your body. They are sealed off from the observation and understanding of other people. The only means you have of making what's inside available to an observer is these forms that you had nothing to do with the creation of. And so the challenge of writing, a challenge of self-expression in any means, is how do I integrate personal feeling with an inherited form,
right,
in such a way that the form socializes the privacy of feeling, and the feeling individualizes the impersonality of the form. So there's a kind of reciprocal alchemy that goes on when you're writing, and I think also off the page when you're living.
Can you give us a sample now, maybe read from one of your essays?
Sure. I will read a part of the second section of the first essay, which is about, it's called Convention and Self-Expression. Just let me set up what I'm going to read. I'm 18 years old in this section, and I'm getting ready to go out with my girlfriend. I'm wearing yellow bell bottoms, and I have a full head of hair. I know that's hard to imagine, but I did once. I did have hair once. And on the way out of the house, there's a wall of pictures of my family, of all the ancestors in the family. And I stop and look at the pictures. The date is, I guess, 1970. Mm-hmm. And so here's, now I stop and I look at the pictures, and this is what I see.
Maybe in 1970?
Okay, in 1970, I see, describe all of the different members of the family at weddings and whatnot. And then, okay, and my parents look very young. They're at the beginning of their life. They're basically the same age I am in this moment. They're 18, 19 years old. So in 1970, though, none of this is really visible to me. My parents, newly married in the photo, look out at the camera, both only a few years older than I am now, as I stare up at them, utterly astonished by the thought. Young as their faces seem, young and hopeful, everyone smiling out at the camera as if no one could ever be as happy as they were at that moment. I don't believe it, not for a second. I don't believe they were ever really young, not young like I am young. I mean, look at them. Look at their clothes, their formal ties and jackets, their cuffs, their watches, the dainty gloves, all the conventional trappings of an old-world dream of success and status-seeking. Surely they must have seen how antiquated and frumpy it all was, even then, when they were new to it. The black-and-white motion pictures, the corny dialogue, the shaky newsreels, the crackly recordings of big band music, and the ancient crooners and the songs, my God, the songs, the cornball lyrics— in a mountain greenery where God paints the scenery. Are you kidding me? Even then, they must have seen how goofily drenched in oldness their lives were, drenched in the conventions, formalities, customs, and lingo of a culture my generation has had the good sense to abandon.
Alan Shapiro reading from his new collection of essays called That Self-Forgetful, Perfectly Useless Concentration. Yeah, it's a lovely image of somebody who's sort of in the throes or in the belief that he's overthrowing conventions, but in fact trapped in a whole set of others. Yeah. In fact, I think in that one, in that essay, that's where you sing Mungo Jerry's big hit, In the Summertime, which includes the lyrics, If her daddy's rich, take her out for a meal. If her father's poor, just do what you feel.
Yeah. In the summertime, you got women on your mind.
Women on your mind. And there it is, the kind of air you breathe. And then, of course, you come back and reflect on that and say, you know, that is wrong.
Right? Yeah, of course.
So what about that? I mean, this idea that we're, and especially in the United States of America, for God's sake, you know, everything is about your free choice and your independence, and it's all commercially packaged for you to look just like everybody else, and you buy the idea that this iPhone is the only one in the world.
Exactly. Yeah, we're all a herd of independent minds.
Wow. Is that part of what, but again, we're stuck at, I mean, no matter where you are, there are conventions,
Absolutely.
You know, there are norms.
Well, in fact, the paradox involved in this is that any sense of yourself as an individual depends on the very norms, you know, that you would think on the surface anyway, suppress individual expressiveness. But if I, you know, if I'm lying in bed at night and I think I'm too short or I'm too tall or I'm too heavy or I'm too fat, I've internalized all of these social norms from my culture and I'm measuring myself in relationship to what I've learned, even if those things have been learned so deeply, I don't even realize that they're assumptions.
Well, I mean, I think that's the power of it. It gets back to our last conversation, too, right? I mean, the idea that what you internalize, if you have never been written into the story, if you're African brought to this country under very different terms than the very premise of white male supremacy written into our Constitution, your story is going to be very different. And how you communicate with people is going to be critically different. So what I'm going to take you off the book, but we'll get back to it in a second. Sort of how do we communicate those things when our very foundations that we operate from, though we may speak the same language, are the psychic foundations are so different?
That is a question I don't think I can answer. Yeah. I have to say, I think that one of the things, I know that there's some kind of reciprocal alchemy that has to happen when we express ourselves and we talk to each other. But how it happens, I'm not sure. I think that I do know that when I was coming up as a writer, I was taught that in order to express myself, in order to be an individual on the page, I had to dispense with all of the conventions, the predetermined forms that that dead white writers, for instance, had invented. And what I've learned over the years is that's a false dichotomy. Right. That the forms and that self-expression and form are mutually entailing, not mutually exclusive, that the only way that I can express an unconventional perspective to you is by deflecting it off against some conventional idea. Now, the thing is, one of the things I think that has to happen in order to make expression possible, self-expression in some unconventional way, is an awareness of how deeply drenched in conventions and established in ideas, how entrenched those things are. Like, for instance, even like the cliche, time is money. time as money is just a metaphor, and it's a metaphor that does a lot of damage, psychic damage to people. You're not going to be aware of the damage it does unless you're aware that it needn't be that way. It's not a truth of the universe. It's just an idea, an assumption of our culture.
But it gets taken in, internalized as a fundamental fact.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about your poetry now, Life Pig. This poetry is based on many of the sad and difficult episodes in your life, and it focuses a lot on your mother's death. Tell us about that.
Well, she died a couple of years ago, and because her Social Security check was too large for her to qualify for Medicaid, but not enough to pay her rent, my wife and I had to step in and pretty much care for her for the last 6 months of her life. She lived here. We had moved them here, my parents here, about 12 years ago. Anyway, over the course of that time, you know, we only had so much money for nursing care, and so often, you know, Callie and I would have to spend the nights with her. And, you know, I was having to, you know, do things, touch things, see things that no son not named Oedipus should have to do, touch or see. And it was, you know, unlike a traditional society that would have a series of rituals that could mediate between those difficult circumstances, we don't have anything like that. We have professionals. If you don't have professional care and you're, then it's just you and the utter humiliation of that situation and a humiliation for both parties. Those poems are a kind of function of our general culture, the disaster, if I can borrow a word from Donald Trump, that our healthcare our system is, and the basic unfairness of it.
Well, and the way we've commodified relationships so that even this kind of personal touching is something that we expect professionals to do, so it becomes a problem when we have to do it, all because of the commodification of relationships.
Absolutely.
Well, can I get you to read a poem for us?
Sure. Let me read a happier one. If that's okay.
Yes. I think this is appropriate.
Yeah. I'll read a love poem. This is about as cheerful as the book gets. It's called Present, and present in all senses of the word, both as gift and as a moment in time. Present. I'm sitting on the bed where I've been told to sit, watching her at the full-length mirror shimmy out of jeans and jersey and then slip on the new dress she tells me 5 months before her birthday is the birthday present I am giving her. What do I think? She tugs the hem down and wiggles slightly as she slides one hand, then the other, over the in-curve of waist and out of hip, half-turning side to side while leaning back as if to gauge the quality, the exact degree of pleasure she would feel if she were someone else like me, for instance, or a younger version of me, taller, no longer balding, seeing herself pass by. So, she asks again, her eyes now in the mirror, locked on my eyes, locked on her hand, as it leads my seeing down over hip and thigh, and then back up again. What do I think? I think my taste is pretty good. To which she says, I don't look fat. And I say after a moment, well, maybe, just a little. Because I know at that she'll whirl round, arms akimbo, the fabric tighter as her chest swells, nipples erect with outrage, the flush of anger in her cheek now almost like a blushing girl's, a girl pretending she's a woman, wagging a finger at the boy I almost think just then I am. And isn't this time how we think to fool you, even now, late as it is, like children home alone in a shadow play of giving to each other the very gifts you're every moment taking back.
Alan Shapiro reading the poem Present from his latest volume, Life Pig. That poem takes quite a turn in the way that it takes us off of this relationship with your mother in this moment into some deeper, obviously deeper question that you asked. Is this a poem? Did you write this before your mother?
Well, this that woman in that poem is my wife. I hope that's clear. Yeah, oh. Not my mother.
Yeah. Right. So, and I okay. Yeah. It actually wasn't. Yeah. I sort of got myself in a mindset thinking that these are what these are all about. So in that way, when you write a poem like that or the poems about your mother, again, when does that insight occur? Do you begin writing the poem about a particular episode like that and then there's an insight?
Yeah. Formula. Every poem is its own particular reckoning with life and with language. But in that particular case, you know, I was just, you know, really writing about this, about how, you know, Callie always likes to try on clothes and has me sit there and sort of and say, well, do I like this? Do I like that? And I thought it was funny that she said, well, this is the, you know, this is the birthday present you're going to be getting me. And then realized how much play acting was involved in that.
Right.
And then realizing, well, here we are, you know, she's in her 50s, I'm in my 60s, and we're playing like children. And then suddenly you become aware of, well, we are not children anymore. And so time seemed to be the figure to address at that point. And that's just a kind of, that just sort of, you just sort of stumble on that. That's not something that I knew where the poem was going to go when until I got there.
And I assume you have since learned the right answer to, do I look fat?
Yeah, well, I know.
Okay. Because every poet should know.
Well, I know. That's rule number one.
Alan, it is always such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Frank. Lovely being here.
Alan Shapiro is the William R. Keenan, Jr. Distinguished Professor of English at UNC Chapel Hill. He has two new books out from the University of Chicago Press. Life Pig is a collection of poetry. That Self-Forgetful, Perfectly Useless Concentration is a collection of essays that are part biography and part literary criticism. He's going to be talking about those books and perhaps doing some readings at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill Thursday at 7 and then Malaprop's Books in Asheville Sunday at 3. And we have all that information at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Ormond, Katie Barron, and Laura Pelliser. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.